welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
Speaking with Clay Steinberger, he's the local coordinator and president of the World Federalist Association, retired from the Department of Education here in the state, and devoting his life now to working for world law. And welcome, Clay.
Glad to be here, and I am pleased to be able to contribute to the program today.
Now, I understand that you started in World Federalist activities back in the 40s when the got founded after World War II, and folks are very excited about the possibilities of world federal activity. And you came back to it in the 80s?
That's correct.
And tell us a little bit about what it was like in the early days, what people thought was going to happen with the UN.
Well, I think that the World Federalists represented a group of people that felt that the UN, while it was a positive step to replace the League of Nations, had some problems in the fact that the General Assembly was a discussion group on issues, and the Security Council, which was probably very necessary because of the need to make decisions, was a small group of industrial nations who dominated the action program of the United Nations. The other thing was that it was, as an organization, it was focused around national sovereignty and nations. And while there were only 35 or 40 at the beginning, we're now up to 188, and anybody with a population of something, I think the latest ones have about 30,000 people each, it does not represent unanimity in terms of what ought to be the actions, and it makes a problem.
So people in the World Federalist circles were critical from the beginning of the Security Council structure and the representation on the basis of nation as opposed to population.
Yes, they were people that were enamored, let's put it that way, but that's probably not the most appropriate word, of the Federalist actions of the United States in 1787-9. Mm-hmm. And felt it made a good model for the world where we needed to have one government with discrete powers, with well-organized rule of law, with an ability to divide responsibilities for actions between world government, nation states, mm-hmm. and make for a cohesive world organization that could keep the peace.
So the current structure, the General Assembly is kind of like our U.S. Senate, a representation on the basis of states.
Yes.
But then the Security Council is kind of like an oligarchic military junta on top of the whole thing, right?
Well, I think that's one way of putting it, yes.
Because the only reason the people are in the Security Council, the U.S., Russia, and what are the France
right.
as a permanent member,
right.
is because that they have sufficient military might.
Yeah.
They were the victors in World War II.
That's correct.
To say that no world government was going to fly without their consent.
I don't think they really wanted it.
They didn't want it at all?
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, who pushed for it?
Pushed for what?
For the UN.
UN? Oh, well, the UN was developed under the leadership of the United States late in the uh-huh. Second War.
Uh-huh.
And became an organization in 1945.
Mm-hmm. So it was a U.S. plan to
well, it was
part of the Bretton Woods.
The planning was dominated by
Eleanor Roosevelt, and there were a lot of progressives. And,
well. Yes, it was basically a progressive group,
mm-hmm.
which still irks a lot of people.
Right. Well, the conspiracy theories on the right about the U.N.
Yes, right.
And for a long time, I know in public opinion polling, for a long time it was a salient question, should the U.S. pull out of the U.N.? Most people don't care anymore, but the idea that we should be supporting these black helicopter flying troops that are going to land in Nebraska and take over with the aid of the Cubans is a long-standing conspiracy theory, right?
Well, there's a propaganda drive on the far right to depreciate the UN as a group on the basis that they feel it would impinge on sovereignty, and they are really wanting to get the United States out of the UN, even though we promoted and created it with others at the very beginning. The Rockefellers gave the land and where it's situated, insisted that the UN be located in New York. And there's still lots of support in a general way for the United Nations. It's just that, like in the 20s, when the League of Nations was turned down by the United States in a far-right group, there's still that group around, a different generation, but with basically the same ideas.
Mm-hmm. Now, the early enthusiasm for what the United Nations could do and the early flowering of World Federalist groups on campuses and everywhere pretty much got frittered away with the Cold War, right, when the inability for the United States and Russia to agree about anything and then for our satellite states in the General Assembly to block each other's moves made the body pretty ineffectual.
Yes, it was, in theory, the Security Council should have been a very active and decisive body. In fact, it was almost reduced to impotence during the Cold War because the veto was so easily used, and once a veto was given by one of the nations involved in the Security Council, there could be no further movement.
Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the Cold War politics played into it, there was also a lot of resolutions that people in conservative circles in the United States saw as anti-American, and the U.S. often was a vote of one or two with Israel against world opinion on a lot of different topics.
Still is.
Palestinian rights and international treaties and so forth
right. That
we saw as contrary to our interests. Now, the decline of the Cold War, have you seen personally, and is it the feeling in world federalist circles that the end of the Cold War has created a new opening for federalism?
Well, I think that among world federalists, there was a feeling through the Cold War difficulties that perhaps we oughtn't to push for world government as an immediate objective, but that we should promote further development of the United Nations with the idea that down the road we would, in fact, find that a federated world government is going to meet the needs of the world problems that cannot be resolved by national sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. There's a group called the Association for the Democracies. I don't know if you've ever run across it.
The name's familiar, but I'm not on the mailing list.
Yeah, I got on it briefly. And basically, their proposal is that only the democracies should be united. And it seems like that was a spinoff of the World Federalist Movement, because the Federalists, and this is one of the reasons why they were irked, the conservatives, is that they thought, that we should get together with the Soviets and the Chinese and everybody, irrespective of their politics, that we should get all nations in the room together and then try to work on our differences. The Association for the Democracies proposal was that there should be a federalism of only the democracies. Do you think that would have been a different kettle of fish if we had not tried to bring together such disparate political systems?
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
I have the feeling that we're a bit provincial in the United States about our federal government system, and that we consider ourselves a democracy, although at times when we drive ourselves crazy when we get bushwhacked by special interest groups.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's advantages to the idea that you maintain a dialogue, a holistic approach to the world, even though it slows things down. I mean, there's mm-hmm. no question that if you have to dialogue to some kind of political decision, that can't be done instantaneously, that we know from our own country that sometimes these issues go on for generations.
I'm talking with Clay Steinberger. He's the local president of the World Federalist Association, the Northeast Connecticut chapter of the Mansfield.
Well, we're now affiliated because a United Nations Association Northeast chapter was founded 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, and we're trying to program together. We look forward maybe to merging down the road, but at the moment our commitment as a World Federalist Group is to develop joint programming.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also a United Nations Association, and what's the function of the UNA as opposed to the World Federalist Association?
Well, sometimes I can't tell the difference. Sometimes they seem to have their own agenda, but they were both basically, at this point, involved in trying to strengthen the United Nations.
Mm-hmm. The World Federalists, it seems, has had a more visionary approach, and the UNA has been more engaged in the here and now of the UN.
I think that's a fair statement, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. Our big problem now is to recruit younger people into the organization who are willing to be more active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole idea of governance itself has lost a lot of its luster. The idea of public service, government being a vehicle for public good has lost a lot of attraction for young people.
It's true. Mm-hmm. And even though sometimes I find somebody interested, I can't seem to get them organized enough to stay interested because of competing agendas in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a huge campaign in World Federalist circles, which was a little bit diffused this year, and that was the campaign around getting the U.S. to pay its enormous debt to the U.N. How did the debt develop? There's a proportional payment system into the U.N. on the basis of GNP. And so we had a certain assessed contribution that we were to make. And then why didn't we pay that?
Well, there are two parts. There's the membership part, which is by a formula that's applied to every nation in the world and involves gross national product, size of the country, and I think there's another third contingency for that. But there are also special dues assessments, such as for peacekeeping. And we're a rather strange country. We believe in a large expenditure for the military, but we don't want to get anybody hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that we contribute in a non-troop way to most peacekeeping activities of the United Nations. Now, we do some, but compared to the total number of peacekeepers in the world in about 35 countries, maybe at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We do very little.
Actually, which is a lot of conservatives in the States seem to have a perception that we are sending U.S. boys over to die in like Kosovo or Iraq, and they see these ventures as somehow extraneous. When actually, excuse me, as a proportion of UN peacekeeping troops, we only have 5% U.S. troops, is my understanding.
That's right.
And we're only 5% of the world population, so it's entirely proportional to the contribution we should make. But we are contributing more financially.
Well, what we do is that we provide support for the peacekeepers in the way of intelligence.
Sometimes support that backfires, like our Iraqi intelligence gathering, which backfired.
Yeah. But we are very reluctant to involve troops. And it also means that sometimes there may be, after the end of the Cold War, most of the conflicts in the world are within nations. And that is had to be addressed by the UN because originally we were to keep the peace between nations. And until Yugoslavia and a few other places, we were not getting involved within countries. Now, we did very early get involved in Cyprus, but we're still there. But that really involved two nations, actually, although the people involved were in one small island. So I would suggest that a lot of the money not paid was on the theory that we were involved because we gave support services to actions of the United Nations, but we were not directly contributing to the activities that were involved. The other thing, of course, is the issue of whether we're going to allow our money to be used for birth control purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an issue about 10 years ago very heavily. Now it's there, and it means that we don't pay monies that could be used for birth control purposes. But that's a bit extraneous because the UN has commitments to mm-hmm. population control, and we really shouldn't be telling other countries what their birth control policies ought to be. But it means we withhold money.
Yeah. Well, we've also had a number of complaints about different UN positions on foreign policy matters that we didn't agree with. We pulled out of UNICEF over policy disagreements. We've had complaints about the alleged bureaucratic waste in the UN and the salaries of UN officials and various perks of their employment. So there have been a number of reasons why we have cut back on our – or why – not we, but why certain congressional conservatives have cut back.
They prevented the flow of funds.
Yeah.
Well, the UN budget is really like paying the police force in New York City. And it's for all the programs, 35 programs in the United Nations. Sometimes there are 20, 25 million refugees that have to be housed, fed, mechanisms set up for their repatriation.
Mm-hmm.
And the UN is just always short.
Mm-hmm.
Because funds are not given willingly, and now we're trying to say that our commitment ought to be, instead of 25% of the UN budget, we ought to be only limiting our donations to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And that starves the UN, where they're constantly underfunded. They're constantly unable to do what they need to do in order to function effectively.
Now, Jesse Helms finally, quote, compromised this year on the funding issue and with much Federalist lobbying and gave a list of conditions on which we would pay up the majority of the debt that we owe, right? And the conditions include that, again, none of the money go to abortion providing organizations or organizations that even talk about abortion and certain bureaucratic reforms. Is that the sum
of
it?
That's true.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is that a U.S. person, I think his name was O'Connor, maybe I'm wrong, but anyway, was forced onto the U.N. as a deputy executive director to streamline the administration. He announced 2 years ago, I think now, that 90% of the reform of the administration of the U.N. had taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's constantly being denied as a reason to not pay.
Mm-hmm. I was actually on a tour of the Geneva headquarters of the UN last year, and I was at the summer AIDS meetings there. And a young African man who was the guide for us took great glee in pointing out to the American tourists that if we didn't pay up our dues, eventually we were going to get kicked out. And that a lot of people in the UN thought it would just be the greatest thing that had since sliced bread if the UN moved out of New York City, the U.S. got out of the UN, and we finally were independent of that body because the UN could actually start to define itself for itself.
Well, I guess that makes some sense, although I don't see how anybody could really want the U.S. out of the UN since we are the only major political and economic power in the world. I mean, mm-hmm. how can the world really reorganize itself effectively if the United States is out of the loop?
Well, I think you could make an argument. I mean, I'm not suggesting that this will ever happen or it's a realistic scenario or something that we should push for, but it seems like the decline of Russia as a countervailing nuclear power or military power in the world, certainly political power, means that it's all these small nationalisms that are the opposition to Pax Americana, that the cultural and political military dominance of the U.S. is the Irans and the Yugoslavias and all the small-minded ethnic nationalisms and religious nationalisms, and that we need to have in the world the rebirth of a progressive internationalist vision that is independent of Pax Americana, you know. I don't know how to bring that back around. I don't know if the UN's the vehicle for that.
Well, the World Federalists say we need the rule of law and we need to have a vision of justice in the world. And we're playing political games rather than facing square on those two objectives. We keep talking about human rights, and then basically what we do is we make pacts with large and small nations economically. And so that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that things could change in the coming years so that the UN structure itself could be dramatically changed? I mean, is there support at an international level for rethinking the parameters of the Security Council, rethinking perhaps having direct elections or direct representation on the basis of population, at least, in the UN bodies?
Well, that's one of the suggestions, and all I can say is that unless these changes are promoted and popularized in the sense we get the public to understand them, we're not likely to move very much.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, I think probably there's more openness to change outside the United States than there is within the United States because of the conservatism of particularly the Senate.
Yeah. One of the ironies, I think, of governance and government is that programs can start with a great deal of idealism, and then once established, they begin to take on a life of their own, even if there's no public support. So, for instance, the early enthusiasm for Social Security, Medicare, and so forth, I don't think that same enthusiasm is there anymore, but the people who are using Medicare, Social Security, the elder population are so invested and indebted to that program now that you wouldn't be able to do away with it. And I think you could probably suggest the same thing about the UN, that even though there's no massive groundswell for world federalism anymore, it becomes inconceivable that we wouldn't have a world refugee relief agency or a world set of programs around food aid or whatever.
Mm. I think that's right. On the other hand, we also have a populist idea that government is bureaucracy and that bureaucracy is bad. And the result is that we really don't face up to the global responsibility and admit that it's going to require bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the arguments that is given to get out of the UN. On the other hand, programs that are not jointly planned with the total needs of the world and with the total commitment of nations can run afoul very easily to underfunding, to some of the things that have happened anyway, where in Rwanda we waited unconscionably long time to decide that it was something that we shouldn't get involved in, and it's still not working well.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about what people can do to hook up with the Mansfield chapter of the World Federalists and what some of your activities might be.
Yeah. Well, we have a website, and the website is www.wfa-unastores.org.
Mm-hmm. Was there much dissension in your group about East Timor, or was there pretty much support for
it? No, we had a discussion of that, and I think East Timor was so obviously a horror that I don't think we had any difficulty in saying we were in support of freedom for East Timor. The problem was that the UN didn't go in right away, that essentially Australia and individual countries tried to control the situation, and it was not adequate.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Clay. And can people have your telephone number there?
Sure. My telephone number is 4, well, I'll give you the area code, 860, because some people may listen to her outside our immediate area, 860-429-4459.
So that's to join the Mansfield chapter of the World Federalist Association and work towards a goal of world law and the enforcement of treaties and world governance and more democratic world governments. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed being here.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.